by profession. He is an attorney. He's a partner and the managing attorney of the Disability Income Division of Dell and Schaefer Chartered. Gregory Michael Dell is joining us on our program. He is going to talk with us about this topic of disability insurance. And there's a lot we're going to learn about this topic as well, because many people who are listening to our discussion today may be familiar with the topic on somewhat of a cursory level, but I think you'll have a much greater understanding after our discussion. Greg, it's nice to have you join us on our program.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks for having me.
And good morning to you as well. I guess in beginning our discussion, I want to go through a lot of different things, and I'll mention the fact that there's a very comprehensive website for your firm that has a lot of information along the lines of things that we are going to get into in our discussion. And just looking through there, it's provided me with even more questions than I had heading into our discussion today. The website is at threedubs.diattorney.com. That term, disability insurance, let me ask you an open-ended question right at the start of our discussion. What exactly does that mean?
Well, disability insurance is an insurance product that is sold that is supposed to replace the income of an individual if they're unable to perform the duties of their occupation. Disability insurance comes in the form of a benefit either from an employer, which is one way, which is called the group disability insurance, or another way in which a lot of people buy this disability insurance is directly from an insurance agent in the same manner that they would buy a life insurance policy.
So that you have essentially the options. There are many of us who, in some cases long-term, in some cases long-term and short-term disability insurance comes along with our jobs.
Sure, yeah. You know, actually, more than 35%, I think, was the most recent statistic, of working Americans have either short-term or long-term disability insurance. So I think the last numbers, there was about 35 million people that were covered by long-term disability insurance and short-term disability insurance.
You know, it seems like such, logically, like such an essential thing that you would think most working people especially would want to have, but is it something that people almost take for granted?
When you say people, I think that more people don't know about it as much as whether or not they take it for granted. The reality is that everybody would like to continue working because it's not a dollar-for-dollar replacement of your loss of income if you can't work. In most cases in which people have a group disability insurance policy, it may replace 60 to maybe 65% of their income at the time they were working. And in some cases, it's taxable. In some cases, it's not taxable. So most people would obviously rather continue working than collect on their disability insurance.
And when you say those key words about the insurance being taxable versus non-taxable, again, to get us started in this discussion, what creates the difference there?
Okay, well, the difference really comes down to whether or not the individual pays the premiums. If the individual is paying the premiums and not deducting them, then the benefits would not be taxable. If the individual is deducting the premiums or their employer is paying the premiums for them, then it is going to be taxable to them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And this idea of filing a claim. How complex does that get these days?
Well, you know, you have to think about the situations in which these disability claims come about. You know, you obviously have a situation where somebody has a terrible accident, somebody gets hit by a car, and they have a real severe injury and they're hospitalized. And those situations are not difficult because it's a no-brainer. It's obvious that they really are hurt and injured and they can't work. But the more common situation is the person who's been battling a chronic medical condition such as a sore back or a sore neck, and they've been going to work like that for a year or 2 years or 3 years, and they're thinking, you know, this is really bothering me, my neck or my back, and I'm sorry that I have to keep working like this, but I can't afford to feed my family and live on 60% of my income or whatever amount of disability insurance that I bought for myself. And that's what ends up making it difficult, because that person's been battling through that condition they have, and then all of a sudden they get to the point and say, I can't do it anymore. And a lot of the insurance companies look at that and say, well, if you've been doing it for this amount of time with this condition and nothing's really changed in your work, how come all of a sudden you stopped? So because of that, you have to be prepared when filing these claims against insurance companies with the proper support in order to prove that you're unable to do the duties of your occupation in accordance with the language of the disability policy that you bought.
So how complex does the law get? I mean, is this constantly changing?
Well, the law, you know, when you talk about the law, there's two different types of laws at play here. One is the policies that are the group policies, which I would say is the majority of them, and I call the group policies the ones that are provided by an employer, and those are governed by a law called ERISA, which is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. And that's the same exact law which 99% of us are subject to if we have health insurance through our employers. And the law of ERISA is extremely complex. I mean, almost every single year there's an ERISA-type case that goes to the United States Supreme Court because the law is so complex. And ERISA was a law that came about in the late 1970s, and the government, obviously, the federal government made the laws, and they left the laws subject to the courts to interpret. So we have opinions on the interpretations of ERISA laws, which apply to most disability insurance policies, that are different on almost a daily basis and are different in the courts all throughout the 50 states.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
So there's no sense of uniformity from one state to the next?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as to say that. There's over 13 federal circuit courts throughout mm-hmm. the United States when we're dealing with federal. Now,
right.
when you have a claim that's governed by ERISA, you end up in federal court. And the circuit courts cover multiple states. Everybody is somewhat similar, but there's a tremendous amount of discretion in applying these laws. So, you know, one judge could find one way in one state, and another judge is going to find another way. And like a lot of the areas of the law, it's totally subject to the interpretation of the judge.
And when you say that there's some aspect of this winds up constantly coming under, I guess some would refer to as the ultimate judicial review, I mean, hasn't there ever been a move to basically revise these laws? I think you said they were written in the 1970s. That's some time ago.
There have been revisions. And actually, when you're dealing with ERISA, and I just want to go back one second, because I was telling you earlier about ERISA, which is what a lot of these policies are governed by. And there's also the individual disability policies, which are not governed by ERISA. And there's something that's a tremendously big difference between ERISA policies, which come from employers, and the individual policies, which someone can buy on their own. And that is, if your claim gets denied, ERISA has an administrative process that a person must go through, meaning they have to appeal. They have to appeal to the same company that denied their claim. And they can't go to a court of law until they've exhausted all of their administrative remedies with the company. Whereas an individual who has an individual policy, they can immediately go ahead and file suit and get into a court of law and have a jury, six members of the community, make a determination as to whether or not they're disabled. When you have this ERISA policy, you end up in front of the court, and the court has to defer to the discretion of the insurance company. And only a judge makes a determination. You never get your day in court with a jury. It only gets reviewed by a judge, and the judge has to defer to the insurance company, which is unlike any other area of the law. You're not necessarily going in on a clean slate. You're going in where a judge says, did this company abuse their discretion and act reasonably? If they did, then I'm going to find that the company was right. Flip over the individual policy. You go in, you ask a jury and say, I think they were wrong. I want to get paid. And because of this significant difference between an ERISA policy and individual policy. Individual policies are usually a cost of 8 to 1 of what a group policy would be. So this is a situation where you really get what you pay for. And most times, people with individual policies have a lot better rights than the people who have these group policies. So it's a, you know, when we talk about the complexity of these laws and do people know what they have out there, tremendous differences between the ERISA and the individual policies.
All right, I didn't ask you this earlier in our discussion, but I guess I should, and we've got about a minute here before we pause for a sports update and a few messages. The idea of the disability insurance that you're talking about, how does that differ from what some people know as Social Security disability benefits?
Okay, well, there's a significant difference. When people talk to me about disability insurance, and if it's on the individual side, I say that disability insurance is like buying a car. And disability insurance is a contract. And in that contract, you get to choose the language of your policy. So Social Security disability, everybody has the same type of language. And it's not a policy. It's a federal statute in Social Security that says you have to be unable to perform the duties of any occupation for which you have experience, education, and training. In the private disability insurance policies that we've been talking about, in which I help people to get benefits paid under, those policies usually have unable to perform the duties of your own occupation. And the buzzword here is your own occupation, which means, for example, Bob, if you had a policy, it would be unable to be a radio broadcaster. And if you couldn't be a radio broadcaster, but you could still be a painter, for example, then you could collect under your policy. Whereas with Social Security disability, their threshold is that if you have the ability to work and earn about $1,100 a month, then they're going to find that you're not disabled. So Social Security disability and disability insurance are significantly different.
We're in discussion with Gregory Dell on our program. He's a partner and the managing attorney of the Disability Income Division of Dell and Schaefer Chartered. He has joined us for the 6 o'clock hour of our program. The firm's on the web at diattorney, that's all as one word, .com. And Greg has shared a lot with us just in getting us started here. One other thing, you know, I asked you about this Social Security disability benefits versus what we talked about with disability insurance. Now, let me just ask you one other thing, because I noticed this was something covered on your website, and I've heard people talk about this. If somebody is approved for Social Security disability benefits, can that person be denied disability insurance benefits?
Absolutely. It's not very common that someone gets approved for Social Security disability benefits, but then gets denied disability insurance benefits. But they absolutely can, because the government has their own standards, and then the disability insurance company is not bound or obligated to follow what the government's findings are for Social Security disability benefits. There is a statistic out there that about 72% of the people who are collecting private disability insurance are also collecting Social Security disability insurance. So another thing you should know is there is an area of law or a whole case, body of case law that says that the disability insurance companies should take into consideration any of the findings of the Social Security Administration. However, they're not bound to follow those findings.
Something I've been thinking since we started our discussion, when we talk about that initial claim being filed for, whether it's going the short term or long-term disability benefits, what would you say stands out as perhaps being most important in terms of the information that's on that claim?
Yeah, I would think the single most important thing is having the appropriate medical support. You can't just wake up and say, wow, my neck's really been bothering me for the past 6 weeks, 8 weeks, and I'm going to go ahead and file my disability claim today without even having seen a physician. Because whenever you submit a disability insurance claim, the insurance company is going to send you paperwork, and one of the documents they're going to ask the claimant to fill out is what's called an attending physician statement. And basically that statement has to go to your treating doctor, and your treating doctor has to answer multiple questions in that form. But most importantly, they have to say in that form, the physician has to state that the claimant is unable to work, and it's either unable to perform the duties of their occupation or unable to perform any work. Otherwise, they're not going to get approved for disability.
And when you say that this is sent to your medical provider, are we talking about the traditional medical provider? Do many people go to chiropractors, alternative practitioners? Are they frowned upon?
I would say that I would not recommend an alternative practitioner as your lead physician. In the many policies require you to be under the care of a medical doctor and not necessarily a chiropractor. I mean, many claimants do treat with chiropractors, but usually it's a secondary type treatment and not a primary. But the majority, and I'd say probably about 99% of people, treat with a medical doctor, because the reality is that you want to go in with the most credible type of evidence, meaning medical evidence, that you can possibly find. So you want to go to the most relevant type doctor for whatever your condition is. So if you have, and I say a neck and a back condition, because musculoskeletal type conditions are more than 30% of the claims that are filed, and clearly the most common types of claims that are filed. So you want to have an orthopedic doctor that's treating you, and your preference would be to have an orthopedic doctor or a neurosurgeon sign off on your claim for disability benefits.
When somebody comes to you for that initial consultation, what are you, in a way, anticipating based on what they are saying to you?
Well, first thing, when someone comes to me for a consultation, I always tell them, look, I got to read your policy, because your policy is essentially the Bible or the guide as to what's going on here. Meaning 10 different people could call me any given day, and every single one of them could have totally different policy language. So if one person has inability to perform their own occupation, and the next person has inability to perform any gainful occupation, I got to know what their policy says in order for them to be eligible. So first thing most important is, what does your policy say? And then I can begin to guide that particular claimant as to where they need to be in order to get paid. The next thing I'm going to say is, have you been treating with a doctor? You'd be surprised how many people call me and say, no, I haven't seen a doctor yet. And so those people, you know, they have to go to the doctor and document their complaints. And very often a lot of people say, well, it's going to take me a couple weeks to get into the doctor, or I don't have the money to pay my deductible, per se, to go see the doctor. What am I going to do? And I tell them, look, if you don't have the medical support, the insurance company's not going to say, we're sorry that you couldn't get it. That's your burden to get that medical support, and if you don't have it, you're simply not going to get paid.
Now, I'm going to ask you a question, because some of the people who are skeptics who are listening to our discussion will think, well, wait a minute, do I need somebody like you to handle this case? Isn't this something I could do on my own?
Okay. You absolutely can do this on your own. But I tell a lot of people that I speak with, you know, most of the people who file these claims on average are making a minimum of, let's say, $50,000 to $60,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
The average age of a claimant probably falls somewhere in their late 40s to mid-50s, give or take. And so if they're making, let's say, on average $60,000 a year, they're going to have a policy that pays them 60% of their income, so that's going to come out to about $36,000. So $36,000 a year, $3,000 a month. Now, let's say we have someone who's 50 years old, and they're going to get $36,000, and they're going to get paid till they're probably at least age 65 if they get approved for this policy. So you're looking at someone who has 15 years of $36,000, which is well over $500,000, and now you're going up against a multi-billion dollar insurance company on essentially is what is the negotiation of a $500,000 contract. And if a claimant thinks that the insurance company isn't going to scrutinize every single thing that is being presented to them, then they don't really understand what insurance companies do and why insurance companies are in business. So it's almost no different than somebody who's going to go buy a house and has a real estate attorney look over their closing and walk them through the transaction, because that's how complicated these claims can be, tantamount to the same thing as what a real estate transaction is involved with. So you only get one bite at the apple from the beginning to present your claim to the disability insurance carrier. So if from the beginning you don't do it the right way, the likelihood is that when you call me after, sure, I'll still be able to try to help the claimant, but then I'm going to have to try to change what's been presented and now present the claim in a manner that puts them in a light most favorable to get paid. So the best course of action is to do it the right way from the beginning and have a claim and anticipate and use somebody who knows the way in which their claim is going to be looked at.
The negotiations with the insurance company, and obviously this is part of your line of work, you know, I'm assuming at times you see some of the, I'm going to say, for lack of a better term, some of the same players involved representing the insurance companies. Does that help at all?
Absolutely. I mean, it just depends. And I don't want to give this impression that these companies don't pay, because they absolutely pay. Now, they don't report their statistics as to what percentage of people get approved.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, for example, we know federal statistics for Social Security, we know what that is. There was a 33% approval rate in 2011. Over a million people got approved. In the private sector, and I know some information from taking depositions of just about every major disability insurance company and from reading all of their other press material, they claim to approve over 70% of the people that apply. So claims get approved. Now, when you say in terms of knowing the same people, when it comes time to, there's multiple stages. From the claims handling stage and representing someone through applications, we've handled claims at every company, so we know all of the claim reps basically at just about every single company. We're familiar with the in-house counsel at every single company. And then on the defense side, when we litigate these cases around the country, you tend to see the same defense attorneys all the time defending these cases, because that's who the insurance companies are comfortable with. And having a working relationship with these people definitely makes things easier for the claimant. I can also tell you from seeing the internal claims handling manuals of many of these companies, there's a different threshold of attention that's paid to a claim when there's an attorney on board versus not having an attorney. And that's another significant advantage for a claimant, because it's kind of like red flags go off for the internal employees at these insurance companies when there's a lawyer involved, because they have to pay more attention to a claim and respond immediately, as opposed to getting a letter and not returning a phone call, or ignoring a letter and not respecting a claimant because they don't have representation.
In that interview, that whole process of interviewing the claimant on the part of the insurance company, the representative, how do you prepare somebody for that, a client?
Well, you give the client the benefit of, you know, based upon their, first of all, if I'm preparing someone, I'm looking at what are your potential weaknesses that the disability carrier is going to be concerned about,
mm-hmm.
and advising them of that so that they know exactly what's coming at them when they get interviewed. But, you know, something about these claims that you have to understand, Social Security, you get approved, you're basically good to go for the rest of your life. Private disability insurance is a month-to-month evaluation. So I've represented people that have been on claim for a year and then been denied. I've had people have been on claim for 18 years and got denied. There's no guarantee that you're staying on claim with private disability insurance. And either on a monthly basis or a quarterly or a semi-annual, the disability insurance company continues to ask you for a statement from your doctor, as well as a personal claimant statement that has to be submitted. So this is a month-to-month process in the private disability insurance. This is always ongoing. So we continue to represent hundreds of claimants on a monthly basis, because the checks only come once a month. It's not like they send you a check every year and say, here's your money for the year, we'll talk to you next year.
Mm-hmm. We're in discussion with Greg Dell on our program. Gregory Dell is a partner and the managing attorney of the Disability Income Division of Dell & Schaefer Chartered, on the web at diattorney.com. We're talking with him about this topic of disability insurance, and he's shared a good deal with us talking about some of the things that happen that, quite frankly, many of us might not be aware of. One of the things I thought of as well in our discussion is, and I almost hesitate to go this route, but with the explosion of the popularity of social media, how has that impacted, or has it impacted, what insurance companies, disability insurance companies, are able to do in terms of monitoring people?
Well, it's been significant. It's another tool that's become available for disability insurance companies to verify the activities of a disability claimant. You know, keep in mind from the insurance company's perspective, a disability claimant's asked to submit paperwork, a monthly statement to say whether or not they're disabled. And the disability company gets that, and maybe they can call the claimant, maybe they can request an in-person interview, but you got to think about how else is a disability insurance company going to try to verify what the claimant's actually doing. And so I know, because I see denial letters on an almost daily basis that say, we had the opportunity to review your Facebook page or your Twitter account, and we saw pictures of you on a recent ski trip or something of that nature, or pictures of you out with some friends, and we believe that if you're able to do that type of activity, that you may be able to perform the duties of your occupation, or that you may be able to work. So social media has just become another tool that is monitored almost on a daily basis by the insurance companies to see what their claimants are doing.
So what do you say to claimants? I mean, are they not supposed to use social media, or just what?
Well, I think, and I've written some articles on this topic, I think that the claimants can use social media, but just be aware that anything you'd put out on your social media is the same thing that you would have no problem telling the disability insurance company or telling your doctor. Don't think that by being on social media, which a lot of people are, that the insurance company is not going to see it or that they're not allowed to see it. Which, you know, really brings up another topic that a lot of people don't realize, which is the video surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
And video surveillance is the number one tool used by disability insurance companies to see what a person is doing. And, you know, I get called all day, every day, saying, well, what are they allowed to watch me at my house? Can they follow me, go to the grocery store? And the answer to that is they can go just about anywhere they want to videotape you if you're in the public domain. I mean, they can't really sit outside the house and try to peep through the windows. That would be illegal. But outside of that, what they're going to do with video surveillance is they're going to sit outside your house from 6 in the morning until 7, 8 at night, and they're going to follow every single thing that a claimant does during that day. And they're allowed to do that, and it's not a problem for a disability claimant unless you're telling the company that you can't do certain things, and then they see you on tape doing those things.
When you're in a situation like that where you've got somebody who is monitoring you for that period of time, and the person who's doing this is a private investigator, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Okay. Someone's being monitored in that fashion. What's most important for that person to keep in mind about their daily activities? I can understand, you know, not doing things that potentially could be used against them, but they also don't necessarily want to kind of become a prisoner within their own home.
Right. You know, you don't have to be bedridden to collect under these policies. It's not that way at all. So, you know, what I always tell the claimants, just be honest about what you're doing. Don't over-exaggerate your symptoms. You don't have to say, I can't walk for 10 minutes, I can't sit for 15 minutes, I can't lift a 15-pound bag if I have to. You know, it's one thing to be able to do those things on, you're having a good day, you go for a walk with your wife for 30 minutes or 40 minutes, or you go to the grocery store for 40 minutes. The idea about being eligible for benefits under these policies is not being able to work for 40 hours a week, not being able to commit to your employer for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. It's okay to have a good day, a good couple hours. So, but what happens is, where claimants get into big problems is they feel that they have to go to their doctors and say, I can't walk, I can't sit, I can't stand, I can't lift, I can't ever do it, never. I don't like when I ever see the word never in a medical record, or I don't like when I read a statement that a claimant told an insurance company, I can never do this, or I can't do it. The reality is, unless you are bedridden, then you can't do something, or you never can do something. So don't overstate anything. Just tell it like it is. Be candid, because the reality is you should be compared to a 40-hour work week and not what you can go out and do in a one-hour or two-hour span. So if a claimant tells the truth, then live your normal life. And if they see you on video, they see you on video. You get in a problem if you tell them you can't do certain things and you're doing it.
What about a situation, and we had a discussion last week in this hour on this program with a medical doctor talking about chronic fatigue syndrome, talking about fibromyalgia. What about conditions like that?
Well, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, those are conditions where first of all, people can absolutely be approved for those conditions, and I have hundreds of clients that have been approved for those conditions. And what makes those conditions a little bit more difficult than, say, somebody who has a herniated disc in their neck or their back, or a torn rotator cuff in their shoulder, is the fact that there's really no objective medical test that can document a fibromyalgia, meaning there's no x-ray, there's no MRI, there's no blood test that's going to say specifically you have fibromyalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, it's a subjective condition, which means it's only what the claimant reports. So when you have a subjective condition, those are the people who are going to be more prone to being videotaped and having their social media tracked and being interviewed by the company, because the disability company wants to see, we see what you're telling your doctors and we hear what you're telling us, but we want to really see your activities. So those people with the fibromyalgia need to really document their conditions, work with their doctors, and have their doctors take good records about what their restrictions and limitations are so that they can put their claim in a light most favorable to them.
Well, if they're being watched in terms of this surveillance, and basically these are conditions, as you've said, that, you know, there's not even medical tests for, how can somebody basically prove that they are not suffering from this?
Well, how can someone prove that they're not suffering? Well, they can prove that because if they get them, let's take someone who has fibromyalgia and they say, I can't be in the car for more than 20 minutes.
Ah, okay.
And now they're in video and they got them driving, you know, 2 hours during one day.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a classic example. Or I can't lift anything, and they have a four-year-old child and they're holding their child, you know, for 20 minutes walking through the mall.
Hmm.
So that's the typical scenario where you see those types of things. But just because there's no MRI or test, you know, most people are disabled by chronic pain. Whatever their condition is, it ends up being that it's the pain that disables them and not the physical limitation of being able to turn your neck or bend your back. And so it always comes down to subjective. And there's no, as great as medicine is, there's no machine, there's no test that can verify whether or not someone's in pain. It's rare that you just look at somebody and say, oh, yeah, that person's in pain. So it always comes down to the subjective complaints of a claimant, no matter what their medical condition is. So credibility is where insurance companies try to challenge these claims. And even in the world of disability denials, when you get into a courtroom, it's all about credibility. If you're credible and you've been telling the truth, you're usually going to win your case. If you're proven to be, not telling the truth, and it doesn't have to be specifically related to your medical, it could be something totally not related to your medical, then you're going to have a hard time getting your benefits approved.
Now, let me ask you a question that some of the people listening to us may have been thinking the entire time that we have been talking. We're talking with Gregory Dell on our program. He's a partner and the managing attorney of the Disability Income Division of Dell and Schaefer Chartered, on the web at diattorney, that's all as one word, .com. The question is this. You have somebody come to you as a potential claimant. As you're talking with this person, you have suspicions about the veracity of what they're saying. In other words, you think that they're lying to you. Does that happen?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I mean, we had a claim, unfortunately. I mean, we had litigated the claim. We filed the lawsuit. The person told me they weren't working. And we ask him even during the mediation, which is a pre-suit conference where you try to resolve a claim, and he says, no, I haven't been doing anything. Well, they call me in the other room, the insurance company, and they got him on video working in a sub shop.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, making sandwiches, taking orders. And, you know, the next thing we got to do is say, sorry, you know, we can't help you. But that claimant has a much bigger problem than just us not helping them, because this country has very, very strict fraud, insurance fraud statutes. And a person who's not telling the truth and tries to commit fraud could really subject themselves to severe civil penalties as well as a criminal fraud prosecution, either at the state or federal level. So there's not a lot of fraud, but there is fraud out there in every level of insurance, and that's one of the reasons why insurance companies are more skeptical of you know, all types of insurance claims, especially disability insurance.
And do they prosecute?
Well, they have a duty. Every insurance company has a duty to report fraud to the State Department of Insurance, and you know, in most cases, they will turn it over to the investigators at the Department of Insurance in the specific state, especially in the state of New York, and allow them to investigate. After that, they take their hands off. They're not vindictive, the insurance companies. They just turn it over to the state and let the state do what they need to do, and they have a duty to cooperate with the criminal division of a state to prosecute a claimant if there has been fraud.
Greg, in closing, and I'm sorry we didn't have a chance to work in some thoughts from some of the people listening to us, but we covered a lot of different areas here. A couple things as a reminder for people who are listening to us of things they should keep in mind if perhaps they are in a situation where they are considering, you know, going this route of seeking disability insurance benefits.
I think what people need to keep in mind is that if you have these private disability insurance policies, there's no guarantee that these payments are going to continue. It's difficult to get the payments initially. That, you know, the insurance companies are always scrutinizing your claim. There's always different situations coming up with your claim, and you need to protect yourself. You need to treat this as a contract with which it is, that we understand, and I understand from doing this every day, that a person's livelihood's on the line. If you're getting $3,000, $4,000, some people get $20,000 a month, you need to be prepared that in the event that these benefits stop, that you could have a near financial disaster for your family. So any added advantage that a claimant can get by having someone assist them or guide them through this process is essential. And, you know, for the people who have had their benefits denied, it's going to be a battle, because once your back's against the wall, you got to do whatever you can to change the dynamic of your claim. And there is a lot that you can do if a claim's been denied. So, you know, I would say have an advocate for yourself. Always tell the truth. Always have good documentation from your doctors. That's the key. If your doctors are documenting your claim well, then you're going to be in a good position. And again, being honest with the disability carrier, you will continue to get benefits paid for the duration of your claim until you either recover or until your policy period ends, which is usually at age 65.
Gregory Dell, our guest in our 6 o'clock hour of our program this morning, thank you very much for joining us and sharing the information you have.
Thank you so much for having me as a guest.